I'd like now to welcome to the program Christopher Bohm. He's the director of the Jane Goodall Research Center and professor of biological sciences and anthropology at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. And he's author of the new book, Moral Origins, The Evolution of Virtue, Altruism, and Shame. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much.
So the problem of explaining these qualities, virtue, altruism, shame, from an evolutionary perspective, before there was an evolutionary perspective, as I understand, there was pretty much a God perspective, a religious perspective on things like altruism. Why is altruism a problem in terms of evolutionary science?
Well, it's such a problem that it's preoccupied literally thousands of scholars since 1975, when Edward O. Wilson first got us all interested in this. And the problem is that evolution is a theory which says that everyone is trying to maximize his or her own reproductive success. And if we're all hell-bent on reproducing as much as possible and gaining every advantage we can, then where is the room in this system for someone to basically do something nice for somebody else? Basically, you're giving away your own product to someone else, and therefore your competitive position is lowered and theirs is raised relative to you. And the genes that make people altruistic should simply go away in a hurry.
And at the same time, on an intuitive level to a layman like me, it seems fairly clear that there would be altruism just because nobody can survive as an individual. There's no such thing, at least in species like ours, or in most species, I take it, as individual survival. You need groups of beings in order, and in fact ecosystems, in order to survive at all.
Well, yes, humans are a cooperative species. And that is where we get the sort of big intellectual puzzle about altruism. How can we cooperate if we're, as individuals, we're more or less doomed by the nature of natural selection to be selfish? And there's still another way of looking at this, and that is just through common sense. Take a look around you and see whether people are truly selfish or not. And the common sense answer is no. I mean, people give blood anonymously at blood banks all the time. They, of course, sometimes they give buildings to universities and want their name pasted all over the building, in which case we will not count that as altruistic because they're getting benefits. But sometimes they give anonymously, and much of giving is anonymous. And that is our true puzzle. That is where we see altruism at work. We also know that cooperative societies such as humans have are based on goodwill as well as mere obligation and contract. So altruism is all around us, and yet we can't explain easily how it could have evolved.
How do you define altruism?
Well, from the standpoint of an everyday person who's simply using the word in its normal sense, it means basically being nice to someone else without getting a reward. Technically, it means giving away something that is of interest to your own reproductive success to somebody who is not a close kin person or kinsperson. Because if you invest in your own children, for example, that's not altruism. That's nepotism in common sense parlance. But it's also, technically, it should not hurt your reproductive success. Because if I give a little bit to my children and it helps them a great deal, and we share 50% of our genes, then I'm the beneficiary. My genes are the beneficiary. And the altruistic genes, or in this case, nepotistic genes, we should say, will not be driven out of the gene pool, because someone who invests well in their own children will prosper compared to someone who doesn't.
You write in your book that human beings tend to be driven by ego, nepotism, and altruism in that order. How did you come to that?
Just by sitting and thinking about it, and also by reading quite a bit of theory in evolutionary theory. Darwin himself said that basically individuals are out for themselves as far as their heredity is concerned. They have to be, because the ones who aren't, their heredities are going to dwindle, and the heredities of the ones who are out for themselves are going to increase. And Darwin himself tackled the problem of altruism. His explanation has held up to a certain degree, but certainly not fully. And his explanation was simply that if you have a group of people who are mostly altruistic, and you have another group who are mostly non-altruistic and selfish, and these two groups get into a fight with each other, which happens with the hunter-gatherers who we look at as evolutionary models, the group of altruists is going to cooperate. And even though their altruism is going to hurt them individually in terms of their genetic success, their group, however, is going to overwhelm the other group. And therefore, altruism could be selected by group selection as opposed to selection at the individual level, which is what we've been talking about up till now.
So an altruistic group of hunter-gatherers, let's say you've got a few hundred people in a band of hunter-gatherers, not of all of whom are, I suppose they're all related. I mean, we have to define what related
means. No, they
means.
Aren't related. Typical hunting band is composed of multiple families that are not related. So when they cooperate, it is altruistic, and that's why our puzzle is such a big one.
So when they behave in an altruistic manner toward each other, and basically, what is that, in a hunter-gatherer band, what would that look like?
Well, here's exactly what it looks like. You have a band of, let's say, 25 people, maybe five families, of whom there are a few maybe siblings, but most of the people are totally unrelated. And this band of people, when it comes to getting vegetable foods, they are perfectly happy just to cooperate at the family level, which is explained by nepotism theory. That is, relatives helping each other, parents helping their offspring especially. But when it comes to meat, and I'm talking about large game, which has been a primary food for humans for 250,000 years, when it comes to meat, these people share the meat equally throughout the band, even though maybe one or two hunters are killing almost all the meat. So these guys are big altruists. But in a sense, they may be altruists while they're at their prime, but when they become old, then some other big altruist is going to be helping everybody. So to a certain degree, it all levels out. But to another degree, it doesn't. We call it indirect reciprocity. That is, in a hunting band, if you're a very good hunter, you figure, I'm really provisioning half the band right now and doing the lion's share of this. But at some point, someone else is going to take over that role, and I'm going to get some back. Maybe not exactly the amount back that I gave, but at least it's going to help me. And that's the psychology of it. Now, the genetics of it is that the band as a whole is sharing meat, and that there is definitely altruism going on. So we do have that puzzle.
Well, the band is sharing meat, and because everybody has that amount of protein in their diet, the whole band is strong, which presumably is why they are more likely to survive. Is that the logic?
Well, that logic only carries about halfway, because the nature of hunting bands everywhere in the world, there are at least 339 of them that have been studied. Nature of these bands is that they are always porous. That is, people are moving back and forth together from one band to another all the time. And this movement really means that the bands don't have boundaries. In a sense, they're just nodes in a network of social life that extends way beyond one band to different bands. And people are constantly moving back and forth. So let's say I stay in one band for a while and I'm getting a lot of meat because I'm not a good hunter and another guy is, and then I move to another band and maybe I'm the best hunter there. So you never know what's going on in terms of looking at a single band competing with other bands. It's more like a huge nexus of bands with people cooperating across bands.
We're talking to anthropologist Christopher Bohm. So you're the director of the Jane Goodall Research Center, and you know more than a little bit about chimps as well as human communities. When you look at, for example, hunter-gatherers and the way they cooperate when they get some very valuable food versus looking at chimps, what do you see? What are the similarities? What are the differences in the way they share or don't share?
Well, chimps are hunters. They love meat. They only eat maybe 5% of their diet to 10% in meat, but it's their favorite food, clearly. They really love it. And chimpanzees have very rudimentary moves in the direction that humans have taken, if you want to look at it that way. When chimpanzees kill, let's say, a large colobus monkey or a baby bush pig, which is quite a bit of meat in either case, their sharing is very different from hunter-gatherers. A hunter-gatherer, when they make a kill, they actually make sure that a dominant male will not take over the kill or feel proprietary about it. And the way they make sure that he doesn't monopolize the meat and use it for his own political and also nutritional purposes is they put someone else in charge of dividing the meat up. Now, when a chimp kills, let's say, a baby bush buck, which would be a little antelope, if it's a high-ranking male who kills the animal, he'll preside over it, and he'll share with a few cronies, but not with everybody, and they're going to be a whole bunch of beggars, and the scene is just chaos, unless you understand what's going on, because the beggars are all fighting each other for position in line, and they're very unlikely to get anything at all, but they're so intent on the meat that they fight or quarrel. In the meanwhile, the dominant individual, who's either killed the animal or has confiscated it from a lower-ranking individual who's killed it, he gives some meat to his girlfriend, to his relatives, to his political ally, and basically shuts most of them out. So chimpanzee sharing is very different from human sharing. It does not have this idea of everyone in the group has a right to some meat.
It's interesting that you write about how there's basically a kind of enforced humility in some of the hunter-gatherer tribes that have been studied. In other words, if somebody says, I'm a great hunter, they get punished.
Absolutely. Hunter-gatherers are intent on two things. One is seeing that meat is shared equally, and the other is that political power is shared equally. And we're talking about the male hunters in the group. If they're female hunters, they would be probably counted as well, but often the females don't hunt. And we call it egalitarianism. And egalitarianism means, in hunter-gatherer bands, that no male can become a dominant bully in the group. And not only that, but if any male makes a move in that direction, he's quickly put down. They're very preemptive in making sure that every male retains his full autonomy and no one bosses anyone else around.
It's interesting when you talk about the chimps just now and you talk about these hunter-gatherer societies, and let's say that they're not all exactly the same, but nevertheless, it's kind of like we see things in American and in highly unequal capitalist societies that kind of more resemble the chimps.
Well, absolutely. And we actually, an anthropologist named Bruce Knauf has talked about how political evolution has assumed the shape of a U-shaped curve. That is, high hierarchy at the beginning. The chimps are very, very hierarchical. Bonobos also are, a bit less so. Then, for many, many millions of years, presumably, we've lived as egalitarians, these hunter-gatherers. And especially for the last 250,000 years, we can be quite sure that we were egalitarian, because that's the only system that would work for large game hunting. And we know that large game hunting is phased in at 250,000 years ago. So up until about 12,000 years ago, the entire world was egalitarian. Equality ruled. And what happened with farmers was that they came to have higher population densities. They had greater needs for command and control. And although most of the farmers remained tribal and egalitarian even down to this day, a few of them developed chiefdoms and then kingdoms and then early civilizations. And at that point, our U-shaped curve goes way up again, and humanity is headed for a great deal of hierarchy. And interestingly enough, we have perhaps two types of society today in the world, one of which is democratic and one of which is autocratic, or whatever you want to call it, totalitarian. There are a lot of names for that other type. And basically, a democratic society is an attempt to make a hunter-gatherer egalitarian society out of a huge, huge society that needs a lot of command and control. And so what we've done, in effect, is to make our societies as egalitarian as they can be and still keep enough command and control to run the place. And that's why we have democracies with checks and balances, but we do have presidents and they do have armies at their command. But we also have very strict codes of individual rights and so forth. And this all reflects our egalitarian background. We're trying to do the same thing in a much larger society where it can't be done with a vengeance the way hunter-gatherers do it.
And it can't be done just because it's too big, it's too anonymous. I mean, the mechanisms that you describe in the book that hunter-gatherers use have to do with basically ganging up on each other and things that can be done in small groups where you can all see each other.
Yes, the hunter-gatherers actually do things by consensus. They never vote. They make all their decisions by consensus. And unless everyone agrees, they can't make a decision. A democracy couldn't afford that. And that's why we have voting by majority. And it's why we have, in theory at least, a loyal opposition. When the opposition is not loyal, as is very much the case in the United States today, then you get gridlock and the system doesn't work very well.
What do you mean by a loyal opposition?
A loyal opposition means that in a democracy you take a vote, and it's always assumed that there are rules to the game, and the rules are the majority is going to rule, and the minority is not going to go up in arms and start fighting, or even, hopefully, it won't be doing what's happening today in Congress, but rather it will work with the majority to achieve the decision. So the decision's made by a majority, but everyone's supposed to go along. And in a hunter-gatherer group, of course, with a consensus system, either everyone agrees on the decision in the first place or nothing happens at all.
And when that is witnessed, when you anthropologists who are in the field are witnessing that, does it take forever?
It's very interesting. One person will speak, then another person will speak, then a third person maybe, usually senior males, but sometimes females. And as the conversation goes along among group members, there's a feeling as to whether they're heading toward a consensus or not. And you can have opposition polemics along the way, but if these people are willing in the end to say, okay, I don't want to keep the group from making a decision, so I'll go along, then you've got a consensus. Consensus doesn't mean a perfect consensus. It means everyone in the group agrees with the majority decision, but everyone has to agree and get on board. So it's not that different from a voting situation, and yet it is at the same time.
In the hunter-gatherer societies that you know of, are there any that are egalitarian in terms of gender?
Of the type that existed a quarter of a million years ago, probably not, because those would be mobile hunter-gatherers who do not have any connection with agriculture, obviously, because it wasn't invented yet, and are economically independent. The most outstanding case of gender equality among hunter-gatherers is the Agta in the Philippines. These people kill wild animals and trade the meat with agriculturalists or horticulturalists who would not have existed prehistorically. And they trade back and forth so that they have mutual advantages, and we call this a symbiotic relationship. Now, Unfortunately, the Agta can't be projected into prehistory because of this, but what actually happens with the Agta is very interesting. One of the favorite meat sources for the Agta is wild boar, one of the most dangerous animals to hunt that exists. Women go out in all-women groups with dogs that turn the boars, and they spear them. They take children along, and if some of them watch for the kids while the others are hunting the most dangerous animal hunters ever go after, practically. And interestingly enough, this reflects in their everyday life. The women have very strong positions within the family, and they have a full voice in making group decisions, unlike most hunter-gatherers. Which has led me, although I haven't published on this, to think that it may be that it's the hunters, not the males, who have the main role in the groups, and that if women are full hunters, they're going to have a full political role. But unfortunately, we don't have many examples like this.
Very interesting. We're talking to anthropologist Christopher Bohm about his book, Moral Origins, The Evolution of Virtue, Altruism, and Shame. Let's talk about selection. This is something that you go into in the book. There's natural selection, there's social selection, there's what dog breeders do, which is a very specific kind of selection that goes into breeding animals of various, all domesticated kinds. Explain to us what you mean by social selection.
Well, natural selection is simply a blind process. Which is basically what got us here and every other living being. And it simply means that you have gene pools and you have individuals, and the individuals are variable. And the more successful individuals are going to have their genes proliferate at a greater rate than the less successful individuals. And social selection is a bit more complicated, and it's only really seen strongly in humans. And here is one example of social selection. Hunter-gatherers have a profound distaste for bullying behavior because this encroaches on everyone's autonomy as a threat, at least as a potential threat. And therefore, they punish bullies mercilessly. Capital punishment is used. Also ostracism, kick them out of the group. These have a telling effect on the reproductive success of the worst bullies. And we have to assume that whatever problems we have with bullying on the school ground today, they'd be a lot worse if it weren't for all the social selection that's taken place for at least hundreds of thousands of years.
So do you mean that people who were bullies 100,000 years ago, let's say some dude's a bully, by the time he gets to the age where he could marry or reproduce or whatever, he's not going to because he's been kicked out or shunned? No girl's going to have his kids?
Well, a bully might actually be attractive to somebody. If he's powerful and a good hunter as well. So it's not exactly that the bully is going to be not chosen by individuals, but the group is going to kill him. And that's where he loses out reproductively. So it's really group punishment, and that is a form of social selection.
But it's only social selection if the guy actually gets killed.
Well, no, if he's ostracized, he's then denied cooperative relationships that are important to his subsistence, and that's going to cut down his reproductive success a little. And all these things add up. So it isn't just execution, but also other kinds of punishment. If the group shuns him because he's a bully, and this would be done in the ultimate form by actually deserting him or kicking him out, then he's off on his own and another group may not want him. So again, his genes are not going to prosper.
Is there a gene for altruism? Is there a gene for bullying? Is there a gene for somebody who's a psychopath?
To the extent that we can find physical anomalies that associate with psychopathy, the answer is yes. We don't know the genes, but we do know that the paralimbic portion of the brain, where emotions originate to a great extent, are anomalous in psychopaths. And therefore, we must assume that this has to do with genetics. But we don't, genetics just hasn't reached the point where we can talk about a behavior gene that we've identified for this or that. There are very few behavior genes.
So we assume that there might be a kind of altruism gene, but we can't point to it.
Or a bunch of genes that contribute to altruism and maybe do other jobs as well, in which case we have a tangled mess, which it'll probably take 20, 30 years to sort out.
Which isn't all that long.
Oh, no, not at all.
Now, what are free riders?
Well, when we get back to the problem of altruists and why altruists don't stick around in theory, even though we've got them going to blood banks every day, the free rider is the main problem. And the free rider has been conceptualized by a famous biologist named George Williams as a cheater. The free rider is someone who will see an altruist and instinctively know how to take advantage. That is, get the altruist to give stuff to me, but I don't give it back. In which case, free riding genes should swamp altruistic genes, and pretty soon there are almost no altruistic genes in the gene pool. Again, our problem is, why is it that people give blood anonymously, adopt children in Africa, respond to Sally Struthers imploring TV spots, and so forth? And believe me, Sally Struthers is an expert in bringing out the altruism in people. That's why people are spending money to have her on TV, or used to. So the free rider has always been a cheater. And what I introduce in my book is the idea that bullies are probably more serious free riders than cheaters. A cheater, all you got to do is, if an altruist develops a cheater detection capacity, which is the next logical step when you have this competition going on, altruists should be able to spot a free rider and avoid him. They can't avoid a bully. It doesn't matter whether you can spot the bully or not. The bully's there and he's got force. So getting rid of bullies through groups that formed moral codes against bullying, well, they also punish cheaters. So groups punish cheaters, and they also punish bullies. And in the case of the cheater, individuals also can watch out for them because they're able to spot a cheater. In the case of the bullies, they really have to get together and put the bully down. And that's what is done through social selection. Now, there's a second type of social selection that I can talk about, and that is reputational selection. And here's how it works. A person is known as an altruist. Another person is known as being highly selfish. Who is going to be chosen as a marriage partner? Who is going to be chosen as a partner in subsistence if you're going out hunting or gathering? It's going to be the altruist. Now, it's more complicated than that because the altruist will tend to choose other altruists, either as marriage partners or as subsistence partners in a hunting band. And the leftovers, which are the selfish guys, are going to have to be stuck with each other. And if you look at the cooperative dynamics between a pair of altruists and a pair of selfish free riders, the altruists are going to do much better because they're much better cooperators. So this is the second type of social selection. So one is punitive and done by the group, and the other is done through group choice.
This assumes monogamy.
Monogamy has never been a huge human trait, even though theoretical monogamous marriage is universal. And you just have to look at some slippage. And there are also cheater detection mechanisms by which spouses try to keep track of each other. Groups also may punish serious adulterers. It's variable by different hunter-gatherer bands, but some of them punish adultery severely. Some of them wink at it. But overall, adultery is not a total free ride. It does have consequences.
We are beginning to understand what groups get out of being made up of altruists. What do individuals get from being altruistic? What benefit is there for them?
An altruist, as an individual, gets chosen as a marriage partner, as a subsistence partner, Sometimes as a leader, leaders in hunting bands are supposed to be very humble and generous. Generosity is a huge part of it. So a generous person gives some stuff away, but then when that generous person has hard times, the people who have been given things by the generous person are going to reciprocate. And so if you're snake bit and you can't make a living, or you're sick or injured, if you've been generous in the past, it may save your life. So your net, the net value of your generosity is huge, even though it cost you something along the way.
We're talking to Christopher Bohm about his book, Moral Origins: The Evolution of Virtue, Altruism, and Shame.